Good morning. Welcome to Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. I'm Stephanie Regal, sitting in for Jim today, and we have plenty to talk about this morning. A special session that ended in failure in the wee hours of this morning. With the clock ticking down, it looked very much like lawmakers might reach a compromise on how to fund the state budget and its $650 million shortfall. But things fell apart at the last minute. Now it looks like they'll have to come back for a third special session, the seventh under Governor John Bel Edwards. Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Advocate, will join us to talk about what went wrong, what this all means, and whether lawmakers will be able to come together and agree on a way to fund the state budget by July 1st. Also, Camille Manning Broom, the new Executive Director of the Center for Planning Excellence, will join us to talk about watershed management and flood control. Stay right there. We'll be back after the news. Good morning and welcome to Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. Jim is off today. I'm Stephanie Regal, filling in the studio today with Becca Dill producing. And what a morning. After a long day and a longer night at the state capitol, it looked like lawmakers for a time might come together at the last minute and agree on a package of revenue-generating measures to fund the state budget and stave off the $650 million fiscal cliff. But everything fell apart as the clock chimed midnight. Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Advocate, was there. He's been there for days and days covering the whole bloody thing, and he is kind enough to join us this morning after being up half the night. Mark, good morning.
Morning. Yeah, it was surreal last night as they tried to get first a 3% or was a one-third of the retaining one-third of the penny of the sales tax, and that died. I mean, it was killed. So then they brought up another one that was a half a penny that had failed by about six votes or so. And then some of the Republicans started filibustering it, and then all of a sudden it became midnight, and that's it. We didn't do it. So they passed a budget that has considerable cuts in it. You're looking at a 30% cut in TOPS. You're looking at a 20% across the board of all state agencies. And they didn't pass any major revenue measures to kind of pay for that.
Wow. So the Senate, though, had come up with, as you mentioned, the Senate had a compromise budget package. The governor was behind it. It was bipartisan. But there are factions in the House that just dug in their heels and refused to go along with it.
There was, and they have enough to block it. They needed 70 votes because when you raise revenues, as you know, that you need two-thirds of the votes in the House. And 70 is a tough number to get. You have about 22 to 25 hard Republicans that have never voted for any revenue measure at all and vote against the governor consistently on pretty much every issue. And they just dug in their heels, and they only needed a few votes to keep that 70. The feeling in the House was that, you know, 2 minutes of midnight, that they were going to accept the Senate compromise. That was, I believe it was House Bill 12 by Walt Leger from New Orleans. And then they got up and started filibustering it, you know, and then, boom, it was over.
Wow. So
they felt like it was going to happen, but it didn't.
297-5633 in the Baton Rouge area or outside 1-877-217-5757 if you have a question and would like to talk about the state budget mess with Mark Ballard. Mark, did you see this coming? I mean, you know, watching it, you felt like at the end of the day, somehow they were going to come together and pull a rabbit out of a hat like they've done so many countless times before. Not that that's ever the best way to do it, but at least it gets done.
Yeah. Well, I had kind of predicted that it would be the last few minutes and then they would have passed that bill, you know, but they didn't. This 25, you know, the caucus of no, the gang of no, have been wanting to do this for the 2 years that they've been in. Their argument is that government spends too much money and that we can balance the budget by cutting all the frivolous spending in state government.
But I mean, truly, there's not frivolous spending in our state budget anymore. And there certainly was for a long time. But at least if they want to get to that frivolous spending, they haven't done the hard work of, you know, unpacking the dedicated funds.
And that's easy to, you know, that's an easy stab at the dedicated funds. But that those dedicated funds, when you start removing those that are constitutionally based, you know, like for public schools, and the ones that are based to, you know, pay our debt and that sort of thing, then it's not really raising a whole lot of money. You're not talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. You're talking about tens of millions of dollars. And so there's been a narrative on both sides of these kind of simple solutions that really don't go anywhere, and that's why they don't go anywhere, because they really don't raise it. They talk about Medicaid reform, but they really can't do too much with that.
Right.
It doesn't save that kind of money as much as they proclaim it when they do the when they do their speeches about it.
Have you all, I mean, and I know the Advocate ran an interesting sort of promotional project in cooperation with the Manship School at LSU, you know, asking readers, tell us how you would balance the budget. Did anybody come up with any ideas? I mean, has anybody really identified any big pots of wasteful spending that could be cut whole hog?
Yeah, and I guess that's what I'm trying to say, not too articulately, is that there are no more big pots of wasteful spending. What you have is little pots here and there of you know, inefficiencies.
And
but that's not enough to make it. I mean, the problem is there's a lot of exemptions, tax breaks for businesses and corporations and individuals that keep the state from collecting the amount of taxes that would be enough to pay for the services that everybody wants, and the legislators don't have the backbone really to cut, because that's what it's going to take, is to go in and say, we're not going to provide this service anymore.
Right.
And nobody wants to do that.
What role is the state's big business lobby, the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, playing in all this? I mean, they're, even though it hurts the state's economic competitiveness to have, you know, these kind of shenanigans going on, they seem very much in, you know, in support of this gang of 22 or 23 lawmakers.
And I would say, from what I've seen, from what I've witnessed, is yes, I think that that's accurate. That they well, and their goals are to protect business tax exemptions and to keep taxes low on businesses. That is their goal, and they're very good at it, and they are very supportive of these, and they, even the more moderate Republicans in the House, will follow the lobby line.
Mm-hmm. What role did the Black Caucus play in all this?
Well, the Black Caucus is a, we keep talking about the Republicans, and there are you know, cliques of Republicans, and they are the majority, but the largest minority, if you will, of Democrats, you still need to have Democrats if you're going to pass any revenue-raising measures at all. Basically, they had argued that, for a long time, have argued that if we increase sales tax, that disproportionately impacts lower-income people, which, by definitions, by the federal definitions, that represents about half of the state. And they're saying that for that half of the state, they use about 10% of their income to pay local and state taxes, whereas the more upper-income Louisianans are using about 4.5% to 5% of their income to pay state taxes. So they're saying when you do a sales tax, that's disproportionate for the lower and the lower middle-income folks, and they've tried to block it all in all. And their arguments for raising or retaining a half penny or a third of a penny were, okay, fine, but how about if we have an earned income tax credit, which goes to working families that make $48,000 or less, about 42% of the state, they're working, they file income taxes, they have families, and they said, well, let's do a 1.5% increase. And that was just blocked vociferously up until the last minute.
Wow.
Last night. And I think if that would have happened earlier, then you would have had the Black Caucus more willing to jump on board with the sales tax.
So really, I mean, it was sort of a case of politics making strange bedfellows, where you had two totally opposite factions, but both contributing to the demise of the compromise, you know, revenue-raising measures.
Right, right. And I mean, they just didn't trust one another. The Democrats and Republicans just didn't trust one another. So we had this sort of standoff of, you know, well, if we vote for this, we're afraid you're just going to, you know, sine die, adjourn, and then all of the cuts are going to come towards the hospitals and the services that the lower income use. And then and that was just, they couldn't trust one another.
Is it time for new leadership in the House? I mean, the House under Taylor Barras has been just a disaster, and it's gone from bad to worse.
Well, Governor Edwards seems to be hinting at it. I don't know how much of a hint. Last night at 12:30 in the morning, he was not in a good mood. And he was just saying it was a failure of leadership, and he said it over and over again.
Wow.
So he seemed to be hinting at that greatly.
Mark, hang on. We'll get you right after the break.
The number of projects with the amount of money that the formula would have given out in the regular session had we fully funded the budget. Now that budget is about 20% is going to be far less, and so my guess is there's going to be far less capital work being done.
Wow. Ray in Prairieville is on the line. Ray, good morning. You're on the line with Mark Ballard.
Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Ballard, one thing I haven't heard at all with the unbalanced budget, if it goes through, if they can't balance it, there'll be big, massive cuts to health care and education. Now, that means that obviously that the rich will be able to send their kids to LSU anyway, but the poor won't. But the thing that bothers me, I haven't seen any.
Ray, hang on. Ray, I hate to interrupt you, Ray. Hang on right there, and we'll get your question when we come back from the break. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. I'm Stephanie Regal, sitting in today for Jim. And we're finishing up a very interesting conversation with Mark Ballard of The Advocate on the disaster that was the end of the special session at midnight. We have two callers on the line. Ray was in the middle of a question when we had to go to the break. Ray, are you still with us in Prairieville?
I'm still here.
Okay,
thank
I'm
you.
Sorry, Ray.
Thank
what
you
was
for
your
holding
question?
On. My question, though, was to Mr. Ballard, if we do have this massive cuts that are happening, and I think it's looking like it, we're going to lose a lot of health insurance, and we should have some figures how many people are going to die for that. And I don't see that anywhere. I don't see it in The Advocate. I don't see it on the news or anything. But I think somebody ought to publicize how many people are going to die because we can't come up with enough taxes to cover $650 million.
Thank you for that question, Ray. Mark, what do you say to that, Mark?
Well, I've not seen any figures that were calculated that way of how many people are going to die. I mean, it's certainly going to have a major impact. It will, and they are going to be pulling out those examples over the next couple of weeks.
I'm sure we'll be hearing lots of worst-case scenarios. The problem is, I mean, there are people who just don't believe it, or they think it's propaganda, you know? And when you have so much distrust of the media, I mean, I think it's just a really difficult situation.
Well, I think we have two bubbles here, and they're not talking to one another, of two different sets of facts, if you will, and what they believe in all across the state, not just in politics.
Yeah.
There's no cross-talking.
That's a very dangerous position to be in a democracy. Dan, downtown, you are on the line with Mark Ballard. Good morning, Dan.
Morning. Yeah, Mr. Ballard, do you sense that the anger displayed in the House is the likely upshot of having a national leader who engages in such vituperation? especially adverse to the interests of the disabled and the poor.
I mean, possibly, I think that does play a role into it. Certainly, the president has given the ability for people to speak their mind in a way that a polite Southern society has not done for years. But I've noticed that even before President Trump became president and this style of politics coming up, that there was a lot of anger between the two different groups of people, and that goes back for years. It was just... In a polite Southern society, we just, you know, if we can't say anything nice about someone, we don't say anything at all. Well, that seems to have gone out the door, particularly now.
We have time for one more caller before we visit with our next guest. Patrick on Bluebonnet. You're on the line with Mark Ballard. Good morning.
Hey, you guys are talking about last night like it was a disaster. Isn't it a good thing that we have cuts to the government? They cut tops by 30%. All these entitlements are being cut. And government needs to start spending money on infrastructure, roads. We've got people in Covington getting killed because they won't widen the interstate there. So I think it was a good night. I'm glad that we're going to see some cuts to tops and these health care entitlements.
Well, as point one, I mean, there are two different sides and two different ways of looking at it. And that is a way as well. Let me point out that in the wreck in Covington, that the governor yesterday wrote to the St. Tammany Parish president and said, you know, look, we could, it's certainly that doing the roads projects on the I-12 is on the list and would have been on the list had we passed the gasoline tax that would have raised money to do it. And that is the other part of the argument, is that if you want roads and bridges, I mean, you have to take a responsibility to pay for it. And that's the other side of the argument.
That's right. Well, I know you will be covering both sides, Mark, in the days to come and in the upcoming third special session of the year. The date of when that starts is yet to be determined, but it's coming up soon because the clock is ticking. Thank you so much for making time to join us this morning after your long night, and good luck with everything.
Thanks, and I hope I get to go on vacation soon, too.
I hope you do, too, Mark. And joining me now is Camille Manning Broom, president and CEO of the Center for Planning Excellence here in Baton Rouge, a 10-year-old organization with a much broader reach than just Baton Rouge. And Camille has been with the organization since its founding 10 years ago. She has extensive experience in the private sector and in government. She has a master's in environmental science. She's working on her PhD, and she's getting ready to head to Cape Town, South Africa, where she is going to speak at the Adaptation Futures Conference and talk about adaptation and resettlement and Louisiana's coastal crisis.
Yes.
So welcome, Camille. Thank you for making time to be with us today.
Yes, thank you, Stephanie. It's always nice to see you and have a conversation.
Well, and congratulations. You're officially president and CEO now.
Yeah, well, gosh, is it June? Yeah, July 1st.
Okay,
June
July
31st.
1st.
Yeah, so I have a little bit longer.
Okay. So tell us what you are going to speak about in South Africa and what work you've really been doing. Because I think a lot of people think of CPECs as bike lanes and roads and, you know, in Baton Rouge and planning for walkable neighborhoods. But you really have been on the front lines of doing some very interesting and important work in resettling coastal communities.
Yes, yes. So, you know, Center for Planning Excellence got its start through the very large effort after Katrina and Rita called Louisiana Speaks, mm-hmm. was, you know, the first regional planning effort of its kind. Katrina and Rita really exposed our vulnerability to the lack of land use and water management that we have been doing culturally and, you know, as local governments. And that planning effort really set the course for how we need to be thinking about growth and development in watersheds and addressing erosion, subsidence in our coastal, you know, coastal communities. It was a companion piece to the Coastal Master Plan.
Okay.
There have been three since then. But the Coastal Master Plan and CPEX's role in coastal communities is a complementary piece to really address how the built environment is contributing to increased flooding? What are the solutions for how we build in the future? Much of our infrastructure is, you know, hundreds of years old. What are the cities built like to address climate change impacts, heavier rain, you know, temperature increases where we've had record increases month after month, year after year, which puts more moisture in the air, meaning more downfalls of both snow and rain, and, you know, hot areas getting hotter, dry areas drier, wet areas wetter. So we've really been working with our coastal communities in partnership with the Office of Community Development, who championed and really to their credit, I mean, took a risk in getting some resources at the federal level through this national competition so that we could go down in six parishes and have very challenging conversations about the future of our coastal communities.
So what six parishes are you talking about?
So Plaquemines, St. Tammany, St. John the Baptist, Terrebonne, and Lafourche.
And these are all areas, the coastal areas of these six parishes. The maps tell us that they're not going to be around in certainly not 50 years, but maybe even less than that. Is that accurate, Camille, more or less?
It's not that cut and dry. We are aware of flood risk, land loss rates, and what land loss rates look like over time.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a $50 billion plan in place at the state CPRA's master plan.
Right.
However, you know, the projects that are set to build land, there is a time period between today and what's happening today and when that land is built. There's a gap in between where we're having to adapt to our communities now. We're resettling the first Île de Jean Charles community, who at one time the island consisted of 22,000 acres, and today it's 340 acres.
Wow. And how many people? Because I think if you're not intimately involved in this project or you don't live down there, I think a lot of people don't even realize that this is going on.
Mm-hmm. It at its peak, worth estimation of between 300 and 400 families. Today, we're more in the 40-50 range. It was a project funded by the federal government through the Office of Community Development, where we are working in partnership with residents on the island and the two tribes that are also have tribal members on the island, to relocating them about 35 miles north in Schriever.
35 miles. And is that area considered safe?
It is. And that's why we have to go so far up, is because the flood maps, you know, for the federal government to expend those resources, it has to be at a low risk area.
2975633 or 1-877-217-5757 if you have a question for Camille Manning Broom of the Center for Planning Excellence. And you were talking about the state's coastal master plan. There was a study that came out not long ago from Tulane University researchers that suggested that even if we were able to do all of the projects, and as you pointed out, it's a long, we're not able to do them quickly enough to really rebuild everything that we need to rebuild. And the state was a little bit, they didn't deny that, but they said, well, yeah, we'll have to reassess that when we, you know, do our updated next version of the master plan in a couple of years.
Yeah. So the bottom line is that there are green infrastructure practices that we could be putting in today in our built environment to reduce flood risk. If Baton Rouge thinks that it's not a coastal community, we should look at the maps, because Lake Maurepas, our watershed flows into Lake Maurepas. And so our watershed is connected to the coastal region.
Well, we'll finish this conversation in just a minute. Camille, we were talking right before the break about Baton Rouge being a coastal community, even if people here in Baton Rouge don't think of it that way. And in other words, this is where we're heading.
Since 1960, we've seen a 27% increase in rainfall. And that is projected to increase by, you know, to 70% in the future with the climate change increased temperature predictions.
Wow.
So we had in 2016, 56 out of 64 parishes declared federal disasters. Our entire region was underwater. This state is a massive floodplain. What, you know, the term 1,000-year flood is incredibly inaccurate for understanding future predictions of flood impacts. If you read the news in Maryland just last week, they had their second 1,000-year flood in just 2 years. It essentially means there's a 0.1% chance of it happening every day. So the watershed and the way that we are developing, we need to understand the intricacies of how our natural environment and our built environment are functioning together and how their flow patterns are also going to be impacted by our coast encroaching on us.
And watershed management is a term that wasn't tossed around, at least in the vernacular, just a few years ago. And now all of a sudden, everybody's talking about watershed management.
Yes.
What that really means is just figuring out where the waters are going to go, right?
Exactly. And collaborating on a regional level to ensure that projects or developments that are occurring in one governmental jurisdiction aren't having a negative impact on its neighbor.
Well, good luck with that, right?
Yes,
I mean, how do you get parishes in Louisiana to do that?
I am very grateful for the governor and his declaration to establish a task force and have in charge his state agencies with figuring out the future watershed approach and how our communities are going to collaborate and work together to ensure we don't have 2016 happening again and again.
So where does CPEX fit into all this? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you all do plans? Mm-hmm. Do you hold community meetings? I know you get some grants, and you certainly, what, like, specifically day-to-day do you all do?
So we are a group of planners, landscape architects, scientists, communication specialist, and our team is funded in part through national and local foundations where we provide best practices on the built environment, or we assist state government in advocacy and support for policies to help our local communities. In addition, we are consultants or hired at the local level to assist communities with planning. For instance, right now we are working in Ascension Parish, partnering with them, leading their comprehensive planning effort, where we're having public meetings last night, tonight, and tomorrow to help develop a consensus within the community, holding large public meetings, talking with the community about what the needs are for the future. You know, you can't think about good design and good community making unless you have a vision and then you have a prescription on how to get there. And so we write those prescriptions based on community input and with consensus of the community.
Very interesting. Mike in Lafayette has a question for you. Mike, good morning. You're on the line with Camille Manning Broom.
Oh, well, that's good. Thank you for taking my call. I would just like to ask for comments about land loss in Louisiana and the master plan that was developed. I participated in that process, and there were no real solutions towards land use. That is to say, controlling how the offshore and the offshore drilling industry manages to drill in the marsh and then offshore. That's very problematical. I think all they recommended was building levee. That's what I remember. And I believe as a professional planner that's destined to fail, because unless you control how the land is actually used, you're not going to control the land loss. And I'll hang up, or I can have an interrogative if you'd like, but I think I've rattled on enough, and y'all been very kind.
Thank you, Mike. Good question. Good points. Camille, What does the master plan say about oil and gas drilling? We know that's been a contributor to our land loss over the many decades.
Yeah, no, excellent point, Mike. And I am less familiar with the oil and gas, and, you know, obviously those are political, unfortunately, discussions that occur at a different level. I will speak to what Mike mentioned regarding the lack of land use policy or direction. Luckily, our Office of Community Development developed the LA Safe, Louisiana Strategic Adaptation Futures, the work that we've been doing in the six parishes. That is the complementary piece and was the missing link that Mike mentioned to in addressing our coastal crisis. And so that initiative is really to be a companion piece to the Coastal Master Plan and start connecting the dots on local land management and the built environment and how it contributes to and can also safeguard in many ways what's happening in the larger scientific engineering world of the Coastal Master Plan, if that makes any sense.
So it's a set of policies, a set of recommendations.
Yes, and our office, Center for Planning Excellence, is working in partnership with the Office of Community Development and Wagner and Ball out of New Orleans, drafting all of those policies and strategies for the LA Safe Parish Plan.
Is the hope that the state as a whole would adopt them, or would each parish have to adopt them? Much like zoning codes, for instance.
And so that's also a work in progress. You know, if you're a home rule charter, you have certain provisions on what you can do, and you have to get permission from the state legislature to enact ordinances and certain policies. For our parish council governments, it's our elected officials' duty to think about the future and the well-being of our community and put in policies in place that help us thrive and have equitable communities and reduce risk. And you do that through land use planning, land use management, water management, having the foresight that you're communicating with the public on where your community is headed and putting those policies in place. If elected officials are allowing ad hoc development all over in places that are not thinking about future risk, that's just contributing and magnifying the issue of flood risk.
But of course, we've done that for so long, and we have never really been proactive in addressing our problems in Louisiana. So do you get the sense, and because you have been around for a while, do you get the sense that there is maybe a new attitude here to address some of the things like Mike talks about or like LA Safe seeks to do?
Yes, absolutely. There's been a paradigm shift in the culture of planning since Katrina and Rita. Katrina and Rita hit in 2005, only 15 out of 64 parishes had plans and zoning in place.
Wow.
And through Center for Planning Excellence efforts and the Office of Community Development putting out resources for planning, we've seen a lot of shifts there. We're seeing communities who had never had zoning before and just culturally, high private property rights, I shouldn't be able to tell anyone what to do with their land, switching gears to say, this is for the public good. We have to develop wisely.
And I suspect that the 2016 floods were also a big wake-up call for those who were maybe still dragging their feet.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's a silver lining in that, it was...
There is, and what, you know, if you look at the literature on risk perception and what we can see after disasters, elected officials are able to make bold and necessary land use decisions and movements quickly after a disaster, but that dissipates over time. You forget about it. You think it's not going to happen again in a while. So we need to keep that momentum up.
And when you get back from your trip to South Africa, you are going to be taking over
Yes.
the Center for Planning Excellence, which for 10 years was run by Boo Thomas. Any big plans for changes for the organization?
You know, Center for Planning Excellence has always been about providing officials and our communities with best practices, the tools necessary to build stronger communities. Our office is, we've got the most passionate people, and what we care about is Louisiana and Louisiana people and places.
So wonderful. Well, we will be looking for dynamic leadership out of you into the future. Thanks so much for being here with us today, Camille Manning Broom, and safe travels.
Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.